Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg, soon-to-be Federal Reserve Chief Janet Yellen, Hillary Clinton. The ranks of powerful women are growing across the top tier of many societies today. My guest this hour, Allison Wolf, has looked closely at this group, at their marriages, their parenting, the hours they work, their status and spending. Their rise, she says, is changing many things. But it is not, she says, creating the utopian sisterhood that their mothers may have imagined. This hour on Point, the rise of the top-tier working woman and the world that rise creates. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you part of the rise? The new female elite? Do you feel shut out of it and worry that your children will be too? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in this hour, Catherine Newman, a scholar on the working poor, will join us. But first, joining me right now from New York is Allison Wolf. She is professor of public sector management at King's College. Her new book is The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Allison Wolf, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. I can hear women smacking their foreheads all over the universe saying, oh, boy, great. You know, we bust our hump to get out there and make all this progress, and it's not easy, and we finally make it to some of the top tiers. And here comes Allison Wolf and tells us we've created an unequal world. What are you saying?
I think it's wonderful that we've got out there. I mean, I have no desire to go back to the kitchen sink, no desire whatsoever to go back to the rest of female history. But I do think that people were often wildly optimistic. They thought that if you right one big wrong, somehow the whole world will be perfect. And it isn't like that. So there's a huge amount to celebrate. But I also think it's important to look around the world to see how far the world that we've created by allowing women to use their talents, allowing, you know, 70 million of us to get right up there, has also meant that we are leaving other people behind, creating very well-off, very privileged families, and relying on the labor of other women.
You're talking about 70 million women globally. Who are these women you're focused on?
These are women who will all have good degrees from good colleges. Many of them will have a graduate degree as well. They are doing professional top managerial jobs. Some of them are running and creating great businesses, like half the female billionaires in the world are in China. But they're also, as you say, they are running the Federal Reserve, running central banks in countries, becoming prime ministers. So it's basically, there's a sort of a sociological idea of kind of class one jobs. Across the Western world, half of those are now held by women.
If we start at billionaires and work our way down the pyramid, what are you talking about here? What's at the bottom of your elite class? Are you talking doctors and lawyers and that sort of thing?
Doctors, lawyers, people who are kind of principals of a high school, anybody who's in the kind of top 15% of the distribution. And they're the people who lead very distinctive lives. As I said, of course, when they're in their 20s, they're not necessarily pulling in big salaries, but they will. They'll be in the top 15% for salaries. They will have at least one degree. They will marry, if they marry, people like them. They will have their kids much later than average. They will go in for very intensive parenting. They're a very distinctive group. And like I said, it's about a sixth of the population. And they are more and more similar, the men and the women in that group, and doctors, lawyers, managers, school principals, people who own their businesses, these sorts of people.
I want to dig into all those facets. It's a very interesting portrait you write. But you have your eye very strongly, Allison Wolf, on history in writing this book. When you go back to Jane Austen, you go back to Rudyard Kipling, a time when whatever her station, in class, in life. A woman's interests were similar. Rudyard Kipling in Barrack Room Ballads, you quote him reminding us or writing there, the Colonel's lady and Judy O'Grady are sisters under their skins. That is, the Colonel's wife and the sort of, Judy O'Grady, Joe Everyman, are sisters under the skin. What's changed? What was that about and what's changed?
I think it's an amazing change. I think it's one of the biggest historical changes in human society ever. To put it bluntly, until a couple of generations ago, your life depended on getting yourself a husband and getting yourself a good husband, if you were a woman. That was the life-defining event. I mean, you mentioned Rudyard Kipling, and there was what was called the fishing fleet, which involved girls going out from England to try and get husbands. And that was
in India, back in the day, in the Raj.
Yes, I'm sorry. They went out to India to try and get themselves a husband, which was an entirely rational thing to do. Because essentially, if you were a woman, until very recently, your life was decided by whether you made a marriage and whether you made a good marriage. And I guess like most girls, I grew up reading Jane Austen and watching movies and never really felt what they felt, because it was so obvious to them that Jane Austen didn't need to spell it out. I mean, whether or not you married was just utterly, utterly critical.
And
if
who
you did,
and
your
how
life
you
was
married.
Miserable. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, who you married. And there's another thing that I had in the book, which again was something which has stuck with me ever since I read it, and it was after the First World War, and that meant that there was huge slaughter, and because there was huge slaughter of young men, there was a shortage of husbands, and the newspapers of the day would just talk quite matter-of-factly about surplus women. There are surplus women because they don't have husbands, and their function is to be wives.
You write, until now, given all that, all women's lives, now being the last of a few decades, all women's lives, whether rich or poor, have been dominated by the same experiences and pressures. And you write, Alison Wolfe, today, elite and highly educated women have become a class apart. You write, they are now more like the men of the family than ever before in history. It is from other women that they have drawn away. And you write about the end of sisterhood. Now, what's that about?
It's about what you just very rightly raised, the fact that the Colonel's lady and Judy O'Grady do not now have the same all-important deciding fact in their lives. If you are an educated woman, it will be very nice if you marry, or maybe not very nice, depending on who you marry, but it is not the thing that decides your life. If you were a man in the past, your life was to an enormous extent about the career you made, the job you chose. Your career and your job, for more successful men particularly, but really for men, were the kernel and core of your being. For educated women, now as never before, their careers are an important part of their identity. Their careers are an important part of what becomes of them in life. They can make good, stimulating, exciting lives without men. And that is completely new, and it's very similar to the lives of the men that are like them. And as I said, one of the things that's interesting is that highly educated men and women pair off. They don't look for mates elsewhere. Whereas what is very interesting is that for other women, and this is the 5/6, the family is still very, very central. They are inclined to often work part-time. I think Americans work part-time less than most people for the simple reason of health insurance. But women who are not in this top group very often try to work part-time. They take jobs which are for money, but they try to get them in areas that are easy to combine with family responsibilities. And the other thing which is just really striking is that The group I've described in detail, the group that's drawing away, they work in mixed gender workplaces. They work with men, they work for men, they have men working for them. Most women still do jobs which are basically very traditional in the sort of thing they do. They're about caring for people, looking after children, cooking, serving. And they also work in enormously female workplaces. That was one of the things that just really took me aback, because I'm kind of used to working with men. And I realized that a very large number of women work in environments which are just overwhelmingly female.
I can imagine plenty of women listening and understanding what you're saying, at the same time maybe being affronted. I mean, the message was, for a long time, when this frustration bubbled to the fore, women saying, come on, let's blow the lid off. Give us opportunity. Let us be fully realized humans. And now you're looking at the population that's done that, and you're saying, oh, there's somehow a problem.
I don't think it's a I don't want to call it a problem. It's a fact. Look, I'm an academic. I'm a social scientist. Mm-hmm. I try to describe the world as it is, not as we would all like it to be. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that we have created enormous opportunities for women. And as I said, you know, the last thing I'm suggesting is that we should go back, or indeed that men should take women's place in the kitchen, which I don't think is going to happen, by the way. But I think that one has to accept that something that has happened that is good for you is not necessarily automatically going to transform life for the better for everybody else. And the female emancipation that people fought for has been, I mean, it's been good in lots of ways. The idea that, you know, woman is a man's dependent has just gone out of the window. But our lifestyle, and I say our, meaning men and women in the well-paid professional classes, our lifestyle depends on other people doing jobs which we have no particular desire to do, and it depends on them doing them cheaply enough for us to be able to afford their labour. So, you know, I'm sorry, I would love it to be true that putting right injustices to women and allowing women to have lives which are very different from those of any previous generation, I would love that to have solved inequality and poverty and all the rest of it. But it didn't. And I think we have to accept that. And I think those of us who have really benefited from the change owe it to humanity to be aware of the fact that we have been really lucky. We have been very privileged. Not everybody has benefited in the same way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the rise of the top-tier working woman and the world that rise creates. Alison Wolfe writes about it in her new book, The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World, she writes. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's just a little snippet. We heard off the BBC today, Alison. This is all over the place, including here. A Chinese woman who runs a very successful online dating site. This is Gong Haiyan in China. It's called Beautiful Destiny. She grew up with very little, rose to the top of Chinese society. Here's a BBC interview aired just today talking about the rise of females, entrepreneurs in this case, in China.
We live in an information age where everyone has equal access to information. It's different from the agricultural society thousands of years ago, where women were inferior to men because of their physical disadvantage. Today, women are no longer weaker than men, and women's time has come.
Women's time has come, and Alison Wolfe says yes, but look at the whole picture. Alison, paint this picture for us of why you say it's creating a far less equal world. How do you see that working? Lay it out.
The most important thing is that really successful women pair off with really successful men, and they do, both sides. The women don't want toy boys and the men don't want dumb blondes. They actually really like each other. And, of course, that means that you've got families where you've got two professional parents, two high-earning parents, two parents with a lot of networks and a lot of awareness of what is needed. And they also tend to go in for very intensive parenting. One of the most fascinating things that I found was how much time educated parents put into sort of one-to-one contact with their kids in a way that's intended to promote those children's prospects. So there too, I mean, it's not that advantaged parents love their kids more, but they know what to do. They're super anxious in a global world and they really concentrate time on them and put more time into their parenting than other families. So I think that's the really critical thing. I mean, there's also a sort of an obvious point, which is that if the whole point is to allow women to really do anything, one of the things that will happen is that inequality among women is going to increase, which it has been doing much faster than it has among men, because all these women who used to be left behind are now drawing away. So I think that's just kind of part of it. What I took away from that interview, which was I thought very interesting, is two things. Both
out of
which,
China.
Mm-hmm. Out of China, out of mm-hmm. the Chinese interview. There was a Chinese interview with this woman who set up a huge dating service. Mm-hmm. I think there are three things there, actually. First of all, online dating is a really important part of our world. And what is quite extraordinary is how very, in a way, Jane Austen-ish it is, especially in China. People sort of specify exactly what
are
they
you
want.
My rank? Are you the wealth I desire? Are you my
exactly.
education
Exactly. Have
equal?
You got the right master's degree from yeah. the right university is the yes. critical thing of all. The second thing is, yes, the Chinese are really moving ahead. And that's very interesting because China was a society which really suppressed its women. And I suppose the third thing I want to say, which I think is one of the good things, is that the developing world as a whole is seeing this change far faster than the West did. If you look at China today and you look at the US when it had the same income per head, Chinese women are way ahead of where American or British women were at that point. But it is a new world, and this dating, this sorting partners by all these sorts of things. I mean, Jane Austen would certainly recognize it, but I think she would be taken aback by the scale and precision.
When we think back to the Mad Men era in this country, the television series, you may have seen it in England as well, early 1960s, the hotshot guy might have married the secretary. You're saying that's no longer happening as much because we are sorting into he or she, if she's the manager, is going to want a partner of equal education status, earning potential, and that's part of what is concentrating then affluence.
Yes, it is. And part of it, of course, is simply that there are more educated women. But even when you allow for that, the sorting is getting more and more obvious. And I think very important for our futures. And one of the things which people in the media and people I know are always fascinated by is this idea, two ideas. They're fascinated by trophy wives and the idea that men go through several wives. And they're also fascinated by the idea that there may be a growth in stay-at-home dads. And the answer is that there are actually very, very few of either of those. Basically, successful men marry successful women, and successful women want successful fathers for their children. And this sorting is therefore, I think, very obvious. And one of the things which I think is a real problem, there is one sort of slight postscript to this, which is that successful couples and successful men and women tend not to have an awful lot of children. They tend to have sometimes none, sometimes very often one. So at least that leaves a bit of room at the top.
I'm not sure I know what you mean. Because they don't crowd
because
it.
Because they don't completely reproduce themselves.
Okay, some room for mobility. We're so happy to hear that.
There is some room for mobility because they're actually having such small families that there's some room left for other people.
This takes us straight to what you describe as the return of the servant classes somehow falling out of this. What's that about?
That's about the fact that this sort of lifestyle really requires people to help you. And again, the history of this is very interesting because obviously historically lots of families had servants because there were no labor-saving machinery, there was no takeaway pizza. But the woman of the house, even if she was quite affluent, was there as well. She was working all day alongside the servants. Then we had this period in the sort of 40s, 50s, 60s when labor-saving machinery came along and servants disappeared and women stayed at home. And then, much more recently, two things happened. First of all, we had takeaway food, which you cannot exaggerate how important that was for women because it meant they didn't have to cook meals every day. Plus, we started to have real, live human servants again. And there's a huge movement all around the world of women going and working in other people's homes, sending money home or sometimes just taking the bus, but basically this is a worldwide movement of women. This, again, is an international phenomenon. Nannies, housekeepers, people to look after your kids, people to look after your sick and elderly parents. This is really the return of the servant classes. And it's about time they rejigged the census categories to recognize this fact.
Some women move up. Other women move in to help make it all work. Let's begin to bring our listeners in, if I may. Alison Wolfe is with us. Her new book is The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. Who would have thought it? Rita in Lexington, Massachusetts. Thanks very much for calling, Rita. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would add one more category to what your guest just said, and that would be that women who move down I was a worked in corporate marketing
okay.
for a large company here in Massachusetts until 2010 when they let me go. And I was not able to find a job. The recession, my age, I'm 58,
okay.
whatever.
Yep.
And today I'm a nanny.
So you've seen both sides of the equation, Rita. What do you think?
I have seen both sides of the equation, and it's painful because I'm a very well-educated woman, but I'm not making what I could or should. And yet, you know, I care for the child that I take care of. And so my comment, and I'd like your guests to respond, is there people who work at McDonald's are striking and advocating for a higher wage. When might she see, if at all, a change where people who are nannies and servants in a home get paid a decent wage?
Allison Wolf, Rita, thanks for your call. Allison, there from a listener who knows both sides of what you're writing.
And what she says is absolutely and totally to the point. And I suppose the answer is again, not a very cheerful one. I do think that the level of inequality in our society and wages is higher than it needs to be. I think there is plenty of room for more redistribution. That's a personal view. However, it has to be the case, brutally, that a nanny's wages are low enough for a couple to be able to pay them out of post-tax income. And so there are only two ways you can go. You can create the sort of system that they've created in some Scandinavian countries where basically the state provides daycare and there's a very, very high level of taxation. But it's still true that the people working in the daycare centres earn a lot less than the lawyers. Or you can have what we have in most of the rest of the West, most of the rest of the world, which is much more of a regular market, which is more flexible. But again, if nannies' wages were as high as those of, for example, Rita before she lost her job, bluntly, nobody would be able to afford them because the reality is that until we invent high-class robots, we need human beings to look after our children, to look after us, to look after our families. Human beings are intrinsically expensive. So, you know, if you've ever been a working mother, as I have, you sort of actually feel like you were paying a lot of money, even though with your head, you know, it was a little from a distributional point of view. So people are expensive. And the reality is that if we pay anybody who works for us anything like as much as we earn, we can't do it.
Of course, there surely is a big enough gap that there could be some amelioration there. Take us back for just a minute. Catherine Newman joins us in just a moment here. But you write about what, in retrospect, seems like a rather brief-lived idea of a sisterhood that would transcend a lot of these things. Take us back to that moment. I don't know where you would see it, the late 60s, the early 70s, the sisterhood, what it was supposed to be, what it was imagined that it would create or engender.
I think it was a truly utopian moment. I would date it to the late 60s and early 70s, mm-hmm. really just going by what I know of it. Because there was this period in the first flush of really organized feminism when there was this belief that all women had everything in common. And it went with a prediction that the old-style family would disappear. I mean, for any listeners who've sort of read their Communist Manifesto and their Marxism, it's a bit like the kind of millennial aspects of Karl Marx. Somehow the world would be transformed. Women would look after each other. The patriarchal family which had oppressed them would vanish, and there would be a complete brand-new utopian world. And it was a brief moment because women had not particularly been sisters in the past. They'd had these incredibly shared experiences, but they competed with each other. You know, women competed for good husbands. Women competed for status. But there was this, I would say, probably 10 years when people felt that not only was your prime identity that of being a woman, but it could be the prime identity in a completely new, different, better world. And I think that was a period which had an enormous impact on people. And that's, I think, when a lot of people really wanted to believe in this idea of sisterhood. And the reality is that not only is the world very unequal still, but the family is alive and well and stronger than ever at the top while disintegrating lower down.
Allison, please stand by there in New York. Joining us now from Baltimore is Catherine Newman. She's dean of the Zanvi Krieger School of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. Her scholarship has been focused mainly on the working poor and mobility. She's co-author of Taxing the Poor, author of No Shame in My Game. Catherine Newman, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
What do you think of this picture that Alison Wolfe paints in the XX Factor of the rise of elite working women actually creating a far less equal world? Does that sound like a fair description of what's going on to you?
Well, yes, we've known about what economists call a sort of mating for quite a long time, and I do think it's a very important contributing factor to inequality in general in the U.S. As Allison points out, you've got people marrying later. They tend to marry people like themselves. Educational similarity is certainly very dominant in marriage patterns. And as she points out, at the bottom, you have less marriage in general. And so at the top, you've got fairly long-standing marriage, much lower divorce rates among the college-educated. And it does amplify inequality because you've got those two high-wage earners in the same household. So I think the basic demographics, if you will, are absolutely on point, and we've known about it for quite a while.
I don't want to be reality-denying here in the face of you two smart women, but there's something to me that seems, on the other hand, kind of unfair. You finally let women, you know, sort of step up and pursue their dreams, their opportunities, and take them, and then turn around and say, oh, look, you're creating this lousy, unequal society, Catherine.
Well, I think there are many sources of inequality, and it's not that women are to blame for them particularly. There are educational inequalities that have been galloping. There are, increasingly we are seeing the reproduction of class from one generation to another becoming more and more fixed. So there are many factors that are creating this rampant inequality in the United States, in the UK, and even in the Nordic countries. Women are hardly to blame for that, but they're part of the picture in the same way men are part of the picture. I should also say, though, that it has always been the case that there were poor women who never shared in this experience. They've been working and toiling away at the very bottom, and in fact have an unbroken record of working. So when those women that Allison was talking about were staying home taking care of their children, there were always millions of women who never had that privilege. They were in the sweatshops of New York. They were working as servant girls. They've always been with us. What changed, I think, was the lives of middle-class women, and they did go through this revolution. But poor women have never had those opportunities and have long been in the, quote, workplace, whether that workplace was in someone else's home or in a factory. They were always there, and they still are, sadly, for them.
Allison Wolfe, we've just got a minute before the break, but let me do a quick scale check with you. In the array, among the array of factors that may be propelling inequality these days, you say, here's one, rising women in the elite tier. How big a factor is that compared to everything else going on, globalization, deliberate policy, you name it?
I think it's only one part of it, and what I really wanted to point out was that what we have here is a group of women for whom the most important things in their lives are very much like those in men's lives. It's this point that you've now got an elite which is male and female. It's a mixed elite, and that is completely new and great. And the interesting thing about that elite is how similar the men and the women are in all sorts of ways, right down to their focus on parenting, not just the assortative, the fact that they tend to marry each other, but these men and these women are increasingly like each other. And that is new.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the rise of the top-tier working woman. And the world that rise creates, Allison Wolfe writes about it in her new book, The XX Factor, how the rise of working women has created a far less equal world, she says. She joins us today from New York. Catherine Newman is here as well from Johns Hopkins University. Her scholarship focuses on the working poor and issues of mobility. Allison, Catherine, let me go to some of our callers, if I may. Martha in Hartford, Connecticut. Martha, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I'm delighted to meet you on the phone.
Pleasure. What do you think?
And I wanted to support you in your skepticism about the thesis of Alison Wolfe's book. I'm very interested in her thoughts and in her book, but I don't buy the thesis that the rise of working women has created a far less equal world.
In which respect? What part are you doing? She's saying women rise, they get positions of power and some affluence that comes with that. Then the basic argument is that they then marry accomplished or wealthier men, and together you have now a higher platform from which to perpetuate advantage. What do you doubt in that, Martha?
I actually don't doubt any of it. I simply doubt the notion that that creates a far less equal world, because it is not the power or wealth or any of the good things that accrue to the women who have so prudently run their lives, but it is other aspects of inequality that are creating the far less equal world we live in.
Alison, speak to it if you would. Thank you, Martha, very much. Alison?
Well, I'm not sure whether we really disagree that much, because I sense that Martha also worries that I'm blaming women in some sense. And of course, the reality is that nothing ever comes from one thing. But I would have to say that one of the things which we are finding is that, particularly through education, it's getting more and more difficult for children from less advantaged homes to get into the top schools. I mean, we've now got all these sort of big databases, and we can look at what's happening. And there's a real worry, I think, all over the world that because education is becoming so crucial to what happens to you in life, it's also becoming harder and harder to get a second chance to work your way up off the shop floor if you're bright, but you didn't do that well at school and you didn't go to the right school. And one of the things which is really striking to me, actually, in New York City, is that I think in terms of anxiety over schooling, I don't know what Boston and other American cities are like, but New York is right up there with Tokyo. I mean, it's even more extreme than London. And again, this is a kind of worldwide phenomenon, as parents who are really worried about their kids and love their kids, and this is, again, it's the fathers as much as the mothers, see education as totally critical to those children's futures and are able to pile their own money, their own education, their own attention into this. Now, of course, there are all sorts of other things. One reason why it's relatively easy to get cheap labor in McDonald's and to have nannies who don't require huge amounts of money is, of course, other changes in the economy. I mean, it's to do with the decline in the number of manufacturing jobs and all that sort of stuff. But there is also a real family dynamic here. And I do think that people who concentrate on education are right to do so, because just as education can be a fantastic way out of poverty for talented and determined people, it can also be a frighteningly effective way of ensuring that your own kids don't fall down.
Which becomes an obsession. I mean, people like to go up and they don't like to fall down. Catherine Newman, you say that the rise of these kind of power couples, with women fully approaching 50% in that power, can also actually become, that concentration of firepower can also become kind of a threat to the middle class. How so, Catherine? What's the evidence?
Well, when we look at what's happened to reading and math scores over the last decade or so, or even longer, what we see actually is the very top pulling away from the middle, and the relationship between the middle and the bottom remaining fairly constant. And I do think that that is a consequence of some of the socialization practices that Alison is pointing to. You've got very high-powered families who cannot actually pass on their wealth generation. What they can pass on is higher education, a kind of drive, and that's what they're trying to inculcate in their children, and that is leading to phenomena like redshirting, in which young boys are kept back a year in order to advantage them in grade school.
Mm-hmm.
There's tremendous anxiety amongst the upper middle class in protecting that upward mobility, because it isn't something they can actually hand on directly. They have to hand it on through inculcating these behaviors and through educational attainment, and that is very pressuring. So Hillary Friedman's book, Playing to Win, about extracurricular activities and the sort of high proportion of hyper-scheduling for young kids, this is all a reflection of the tournaments that upper-middle-class kids are being put through in order to ensure, or at least their parents hope, ensure their way through the bottleneck of elite higher education.
And once you get this sort of
concentration of advantage, but it's very pressured.
And you get this kind of higher class sort of floating up in a way. You remind us, Catherine, that these couples are willing to take pretty extreme measures to have their kids stay up there, even putting them on drugs.
Well, there certainly is some evidence to suggest that the kinds of medications that are given to kids who are ADHD, young boys in particular, is disproportionately a strategy, if you will, in high-end school districts. But so, as I said, is redshirting. So there are many ways in which families are anxious about the performance of their kids because they understand how they got to be where they are, and they're trying to ensure the same future for their children. And I don't think they should be criticized for that. It's very understandable. They know what tournaments await their children, and they're trying to prepare them for it. But as Allison points out, the children of the working poor, who I've studied extensively, don't have any of those opportunities, and they aren't putting their kids through that tournament because they can't. And so it means that inherited position becomes more and more dispositive of life chances, and that's not what the country's supposed to stand for.
Catherine, sisterhood, back in the late 60s, early 70s idea, Alison Wolfe reminds us, one of the ideas was take down the patriarchy. In this reality that's rolled out, what do you see happening with the family and the patriarchy, Catherine?
Well, I think Allison is correct to say that men and women who are at the top of the heap are becoming more and more alike, and the patriarchy issue just isn't that important to them in the family. In the workplace, gender dynamics are still there. We still see a smaller proportion of women who are CEOs, and so some of those issues certainly remain. But within the family, I think she's absolutely right that you see a real commonality between men and women in what they expect and how they devote themselves to child rearing. The men are just as involved as the women, and all of them are depending on this other labor force without which their lives would be impossible.
That sort of low income, what Allison calls the return of the servant class. Let's go to Esty calling from Boston. Hi, Esty, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I think that the other concern, as you just mentioned with the power couple, is that one of the reasons that, for example, women aren't choosing men that are possibly less educated, smart, whatever, is because men aren't interested or feel comfortable enough just being the second wage or wage earner or more parenting. And I disagree that men and women are still doing equal share of work at the home. Parenting is still a sex-based classification in that women are still given most of the responsibility, and you still look askew at a man who says they're staying home at the children. That's changing, but it's at the very tip of the iceberg. And so men have always had the ability to marry anyone they want in terms of class and economic or whatever. But women still aren't received to have that same freedom. I'd be interested in what your guests have to say about that.
Allison, what about that? Constraints on who's married. Is this voluntary, this sort of mating up at the top? Or should, could, might women have the same freedom to reach across class lines?
Well, I think the brutal fact is that women want a really good father for their kids when they marry. And one of my friends, who's one of the extremely unusual people who has ended up as the main wage earner, put this to me very, very clearly, because when she and her husband married, they didn't expect it to be that way round. And her view was that there are probably a lot of men out there who would be actually quite happy to be just at home and not doing very much, but that they weren't the sort of man that she was interested in marrying, and not the sort of man she did marry. And she can't see that it's coming on a large scale. And the statistics certainly bear her out. I do completely agree with Esty that that women, on the whole, across the population, still do more of the childcare. But I'd add two things to that. One of them is that in terms of total numbers of working hours, every country practically in the world, what is interesting is that men and women put in the same number of hours of work. So when you add together housework, childcare, paid work, commuting, all the things we sort of think of as work, that's equal. It is true that women on the whole do more hours of childcare and men do more hours of work. But compared to their fathers, the current generation of professional educated men are just sort of way out there. They are doing just so much more than their fathers or their grandfathers ever did. So I don't think it will ever be absolutely identical, but it is just so staggeringly much more equal than it used to be in terms of the amount of parenting and childcare that goes on, that I think it deserves to be called a revolution.
Dave in Wheeling, Illinois. Thanks for calling, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to tell you how interesting this whole thing has been. My wife and I have been married for 42 years, started out as the traditional relationship, evolved into this power couple that you're talking about.
Okay.
And I have continued that evolution to where I am now the home person. I take care of the grandkids. I take care of the cooking and all the stuff at home. And it's easy to identify with some of the issues that your guests are talking about, you know, with all of the internal wrestling that you do, self-deprecation, devaluation of what you do, and working to accept the thanks of family and children and grandchildren that you're actually doing things that are of great value.
I take it that your wife moved into the working world alongside you, did very well there. Now you've moved out. She's still there, I guess, Dave. What about that loss of income? Do you feel it now that you're you know, only one in that world?
Yeah, we've been very fortunate to have saved rather conservatively over the years, and it's been a little easier, although we certainly do, for the first time in our lives, quite honestly, find ourselves budgeting.
So move out of the power couple ranks and you'll feel it. Dave, I appreciate your call. Allison, here's Angie writing to us. She says, I don't believe you're defining elite properly. Angie writes, elite is not the size of a paycheck or education you have. It's what truly valuable effect you have on the world. Sure, these women you're talking about have done well for themselves, but what do they do for the future of the majority of people with no opportunity or possibility of moving? There's a listener who wants to define elite in a quite different, more philanthropic way, Allison.
Well, I wish her luck, because I completely agree that how much we respect people should not be about the size of their paycheck or how much education they have. I'm using elite in the kind of classic way that I guess newspapers do, media does, certainly my academic life does. I do think, and this is, I suppose, in a way where I'm agreeing with her, that while it has the change has been great for women, and it has been something which I'm sure has added a lot of growth and wealth to the world, mm-hmm. there has been a real downside for certain parts of society, because there was a period of history when middle-class women who were quite comfortably off, active, energetic, creative, educated, poured all their energy into what used to be derogatively called do-gooding, but was actually doing good.
The PTA presidents,
mm-hmm. the people who were the backbone of churches and going out and working with charities and mm-hmm. all of this stuff. And of course, the reality is that if you have two people working and you have a world in which it's actually increasingly difficult to live off one salary, because if everybody else has got two,
yep,
it's hard
yep.
with one, mm-hmm. That is one of the things that suffers. And my hope is that as we adjust to this world, more and more people will see this as something that you ought to do as you get towards the end of your working life and you're not putting in so many hours and you've got decades of good health ahead of you. But at the moment, I would have to say that compared to when I was growing up, the charities and charitable activity have been real losers. And I do think that we should do what we can to point this out and encourage people to try and plan it in their life plans alongside the cruises.
Yeah, Catherine Newman, help us out here. If we've got a lot of truth on the table here, how do you support women, but maybe mindfully offset the inequality or class stratification that may come with this rise, with women's long-sought advance? What practically as societies might we do?
Well, I think we have to reduce as best we can the impact of the family on the life chances of their children, which means investments in early childhood education, investments in after-school care, investments in child care, all the kind investments in access to higher education, all the ways in which we as a society underwrite mobility. If we leave this entirely to the resources of families, then we will see the replication of inequality from one generation to the next.
More now than ever, you're saying, with this rise.
More now than ever. But it's not impossible. possible. And when you look at other societies and their investment patterns, still true in the Nordic countries, you see more or less cradle-to-grave social policies. It means that you've got easily available child care, easily available elder care. All of those things reduce the connection between the private resources of families and the fate of the next generation. So I don't think these things are impossible to fix, but the more we withdraw, shall we say, social resources, the kinds of things that, you know, states did when they paid for public higher education, and the more we privatize the sort of pathways to mobility, the more these class patterns will replicate themselves.
Well, this is a fascinating kind of light shown on a world we've moved into. Congratulations for all the people, women, who have moved up here. Congratulations to you, Alison Wolf, for sort of saying, all right, good on them. And here's where that brings us, a kind of recalibration going on here. Catherine Newman, it's been wonderful to have you with us in this hour from Johns Hopkins. You're terrific. Thank you so much for joining us today. Alison Wolf's new book is The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. Alison, thanks very much to you as well. Good luck and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Listeners, be with us tomorrow. In this hour, we will talk with NBA legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Do not miss it. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.